Me. Hey, guys. Welcome to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Some of you like it. That should be my tagline. Instead of libertarian foreign policy, mostly it should be, some people think it's okay. All right, well. Hey, chat room guys, there's not very many of you today. Where's everybody else? Maybe you should email them and remind them what time it is. Morning to you guys. Assuming you're in Texas or west of there. I'm drinking Darren's coffee. I'm waking up. I've been awake for about 5 hours, but I'm still working on it. I got news and complaining to do on the show today. And I got a couple of great interviews coming up. First of all, Nebojša Malić will be on. I interviewed him last night and recorded it. I try to never do that. But, hey, for Nebojša, I will. And why? Because there's a color-coded revolution going on in Macedonia. And, so, he knows what's up, man. It's Nebojša. So, I decided to ask him questions. Now, the problem is, I'm horrible on the Balkans, man. I'm horrible on even the geography around there. And so, I sound like an idiot throughout the whole interview, because I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm trying my best to ask him questions based on very little knowledge of my own, and didn't really work out too well. But he said good stuff. So, if you just try to block out the me part and just listen to Nebojša talking, then you'll learn some cool stuff about what's going on in Macedonia right now. That's coming up in just a little while. And then Will Grigg is going to be on for a full hour today on the show, because there's so much stuff to talk about with Will Grigg that I thought, you know, I think maybe I better have him on for a good 4 segments here. You know, so we can talk about stuff. So that's all coming up on the show today. Ain't you lucky? Yeah. Say what you will about Scott Horton. He does have an impeccable taste in guests. Yeah, I do. And that Will Grigg, he's a talented writer. You guys read his blog all the time? I hope you do. He talks good, too. Real good. But, boy, what a talented writer. All right. So, yeah. ScottHorton.org. That's my website. Stop by ScottHorton.org if you want to listen to stuff. I got whole show archives and, interview only archives going back to 2003 there. Well, the whole show archives only go back to like 2010 or something. But the interview archives, there's about 3,800 of them now going back to 2003 there. At scotthorton.org/interviews. And there's a chat room if you want to hang out with the guys. Talk El Caminos or whatever it is that you're interested in. Yeah, lots of people talk about lots of stuff in there. It's a chat room for crying out loud. That's scotthorton.org/chat. So you can hang out in there. Talk about how much you like Will Grigg or, you know, whatever it is. And that's pretty cool. And then check this out. And man, I gotta remember to say this all the time now. I gotta say this at the beginning of these interviews and at the end of the interviews so people only listening to the interview archives know it too. I got transcripts for sale. People say, where's the transcripts, man? We need to have transcripts. Well, you transcribe them. It's hard. And it's expensive. You're gonna hire somebody to do it. It's not like we got a bunch of zillionaire socialists financing us like Amy Goodman or something here on this show. Only broke-ass capitalists. It's kind of strange. And so, yeah, you know, who's going to pay for that? Well, you are, if you want transcripts. But we're only charging $2 for them. Or was it $2.50 or something? And then you get a transcript. And then I want to have it where the deal is, where if you pay $150, then from now on, anytime anybody gets a transcript done, you get it too. And you'll be in the lifelong transcript getter club. Don't you think that's cool? Now, I'm going to have to remember to put a link up at the top or figure out how to, or get Matt to put one up there, or Dave or somebody. Put a link up at the top of the page. Maybe put a link at the bottom of each interview archive that, like, click here to buy a transcript of this thing. Don't you think that'd be cool? Oh, Will Grigg, he'll be on in, say, 55 minutes from now. Chat room questioner person. But yeah, man, I want to sell you guys transcripts. And people ask for transcripts. Hey, you got a transcript of this? You got a transcript of that? Sorry, wish I did. But now, I've got a volunteer who is so damn good at transcribing things that she is basically willing to do it for this very low affordable rate. Seemed like a good idea to get you guys to do that. And then wouldn't that be great if, you know, maybe we could do a thing where, you know, I don't know, after 6 months or something, the transcripts actually get posted on the archive so they're searchable later, you know, after a good period of time has lapsed, so that people who are paying money have an advantage there with it, kind of thing. But, and then wouldn't that be great if you people bought every interview transcript all the time, and then ultimately we would have a text archive of the interviews of this show? Wouldn't that be something? That might be something. All right. But anyway, so transcripts. Buy them for the low, low price of $2.50, which is not very much money, really, right? And that's like a third of a pack of cigarettes now, a fourth. And then also, I'm doing this raffle thing. I don't have all the details set exactly, but it's an awesome vacation retreat thing in the jungle of Costa Rica, and I'm going to sell raffle tickets for it, and I'm going to try to sell a whole hell of a lot of them. And then you and a companion of your choice. No, I get to choose who you take with you. No. You and a companion of your choice get to go live in the jungle for a week and eat food and have a room and do adventurous and fun stuff and whatever kind of crap. Donated by a listener to this show. Isn't that cool? So we're going to do that. I'll have many more details once I have details. But that thing is on. So I hope you start thinking in your off time about how much you would like to go to Costa Rica. As soon as Scott Horton starts giving me details about this raffle, I think I'm going to go ahead and buy one of those tickets because I think I would like to go to Costa Rica. These are the kinds of thoughts that will be firing around in your neurons. And then money you'll give in exchange for a raffle ticket. It's going to be awesome if you win, which you might if you're lucky. So that's coming up. What a great idea. You know, that's what I need. For other people to come up with great ideas for ways that I can make some money. Because I would have never thought of that in a million years. Because I am just not that clever. But, yeah. Friend of the show thought of it for me. Perfect idea. So that's coming up. Look forward to that. You might go live in the jungle for a while. And then real quick here before the break, let me tell you, I've said a number of times on this show that Josh Rogan is kind of a neocon, and he writes as a partner with Eli Lake, the lunatic liar all the time, which is problematic, but that he does good journalism, and I've never really caught him lying or pushing completely ridiculous stuff, even if I disagree even strongly with his kind of spin on it. Does good work most of the time. But then this morning I read a thing by him saying that the Russians are driving around with mobile crematoriums in eastern Ukraine to destroy all the bodies of dead Russian soldiers. And his source was congressman. He didn't even try to verify it with the military, the CIA, or anybody else.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more war in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C., but those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America Lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel Lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. All right, y'all. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Again, Neboj Samalich is coming up. Interview I recorded with him last night. And then Will Gregg will be on at 1 Eastern, 12 Texas time to talk about all kinds of good stuff. I mean, horrible, horrible stuff. Anyway, so that only leaves me one more segment to kill here. I got so much to get rid of. First of all, I just want to note the fact that this just keeps getting better and better. Clinton Foundation donors got weapons deals from Hillary Clinton's State Department. Oh, and it's by David Sirota. Isn't that interesting? You know, he's the kind of liberal, left-wing, progressive activist type. He's not a communist. He's more like a progressive, like kind of a left-wing Democrat in a way, you know, kind of one of those guys. But he's good enough on, or you might even say bad enough on kind of categorizing kind of populist right-wingers as all very radical right when they're not necessarily all that radical. Most of them. But anyway, he's good enough on the details of some of those stories to, I believe in the past, have questioned McVeigh's aloneness in the Oklahoma bombing plot, which that's a certain kind of progressive or liberal who's willing to say, hey, what about the Bill Clinton Justice Department not telling us the whole truth about that story? Most would rather just ignore it and move on to the next one, if you understand what I mean. So I have a certain amount of grudging respect for Sirota, although he's pretty cookie-cutter, left liberal on most stuff. But anyway, Clinton Foundation donors got weapons deals from Hillary Clinton's State Department. So here he is again, willing to challenge the Clintons, and in a pretty severe way. And of course, I haven't read this dang thing yet. I'm scanning through looking for the word Israel, because I think this is all just about the Gulf Cooperation Council, the Saudis, let's see, Algeria, Saudi, Kuwait, UAE, Oman, and Qatar are listed here. Where's Israel? Wait till we find out how many Israeli nationals, as well as possibly dual citizens, have donated to the foundation. Does that count? Or is Israel the only state in the union without defined borders? Is that how that works? They don't need two senators because then they'd be sacrificing the other 100 that they have. Very interesting. And, you know, they still get a year and a half to go. Now, I don't know anyone who could outcompete her. I mean, I guess it's possible that Jim Webb could just completely up his game by 6,000% somehow and push her out and get the nomination. I don't know enough about this O'Malley guy, but with a name like that, that means he's Catholic, right? So that's a big uphill thing to climb there with American bigots. They are, man. They're scared of the Pope and stuff. He came out against the military-industrial complex. You hear that? You can't trust a guy like that. And I don't know enough about that guy O'Malley, but he doesn't seem, from what I know of him, he doesn't seem to have near enough charisma to get the nomination. Obama, in challenging Clinton, he had a ton of power already lined up before 2007 even started. You know, he was ready already. He'd been recruited from within the top ranks of the Democratic Party that were split from the Clintons then. I don't believe that they have a character like that now. But Hillary is so flawed. I mean, she's just horrible, dude. I'm not going to waste the show sitting here going down the list. I'm just saying, look at how hilarious this is that, you know, here with a year and a half to go with her, I really don't like that lady numbers as high as they've ever been, near 50%, and with virtually no hope of getting much better than that, with her last book being a complete flop because she already was so 2000 and 1 2,000 years ago. She's over. Everybody hates her. Women hate her. Men hate her. She's the boss that you can't stand. Now, Eric Garris argues that Americans, and in fact, this is like what, I guess what Carlin said about Bill, right? Was he's the worst liar in the world, and Americans like that about him. He's completely and totally and stunningly full of it. And hey, at least he's honest. And so, hey, you know, Americans, maybe they think that that's the kind of thing that they need is a ruthless, dishonest, corrupt operator like Hillary Clinton to hold this empire down, man. Get business done. But I kind of don't think so. I kind of think they vote for who they think that they like. And I don't think people like Hillary Clinton. I think if they ever did, it was over by now kind of thing. It is over by now. So anyway, it's going to be fun to watch her floundering around. But this is, you know, the main reason why for years now. What is it, 2015? I should have wrote this down on a calendar somewhere. Should have written it down on a calendar somewhere when I started calling it for Jeb. But I don't think she stands a chance against him. And because this stuff is just going to keep coming up over and over and over again, too. You know, Greg Pallas has stuff all about the electric bills in Pakistan and all this money she was using all this, back in 1998 or whatever. Her old law firm's client was this, electric company that had some kind of deal with the Pakistanis, some kind of crap, or maybe it was just the bank, a bank that she had represented, had a deal with a Pakistani electric company, something like that. And anyway, she used the full state power of the American Empire in order to put an IMF chokehold on the Pakistanis until they would cough up the money to her favored cronies. That was back then. That was Greg Pallas writing back before the turn of the century about this lady. And anyway, it's going to keep going on, and we still got so much time to go. It's like the slowest motion train wreck, but it's one that I think that we can enjoy, right? Knowing that every single day in her private moments, Hillary Clinton is going, well, whatever, not having a good time. She wants it so bad, but nobody wants to give it to her. Oh, except the flip side of this is, look at all the liberals lining up behind her, even though they hate her, even though they know better, even though they vastly preferred Obama to her 8 years ago, whatever. Hey, at least she's not Jeb Bush and all that kind of thing. And that goes from across, not everyone, but some from every part of the left spectrum, right? From Commie to Brzezinski. Amazing. Hillary Clinton. All right, now more important news. In case you missed this, you should know about this. Judicial Watch, which is Larry Klayman, the right-wing guy who sits around suing the government all day, and who is at least a half a nut, but I don't mind, gets some work done. Oh, man, am I already out of time? Boy, I went on way too long about that. Well, they leaked this DIA report to him, or it came out through a FOIA, actually, about how they knew good and well the consequences of their policy in Syria, dated 2012. And they kept doing it anyway, and then all the worst of it came true. And you could read about it at LevantReport.com, for example. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The next one is June 13th in Denver. It's just $5 if you sign up now at taxpayersunited.org/govpensions. Introducing Nebojša Malić. He's a former regular columnist for antiwar.com for years and years. He's now writing as a journalist for RT. And of course he has his own blog, Gray Falcon. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Nabosa?
Good, thank you. Thank you for having me back.
Very happy to have you here, and very interested to know what you have to say about what is going on in Macedonia right now. And I guess, you know, well, people find out real quick why this is important, but it seems like there's a big to-doings going on and that maybe it's got something to do with the United States and its interests.
Well, let me start off with something I said on Twitter last week, maybe a week before, when the thing started happening. I said one look at the map should explain everything. Back in September, when Bulgaria, at the behest of the United States government, or specifically after the visit by Senator McCain, told the Russians that they can no longer run the pipeline through the gas pipeline that they had agreed upon a decade ago, and that was supposed to start supplying gas to Europe without having to worry about the government of Ukraine shutting it down like it did in 2009. The Russians went to Turkey and said, fine, you know, can we run the pipeline through Turkey? And the Turks said, sure, that's a great idea. And then we run it through Greece and then onward to Europe. Well, how do you get gas to Europe through Greece? You can't go through Bulgaria because the Americans will again send McCain and he will say, no gas. And the Bulgarians will obediently say, no gas, because the government there is entirely controlled by Washington, unfortunately. Or controlled, period, is, I guess, a bigger problem. It would be bad if it were controlled by anybody else either. And so the only way the gas can go from Greece is through Macedonia and on to Serbia, which is still on board with the pipeline, and then onward to Hungary, which is also still on board with the pipeline, to the great consternation of European Union officials that are doing everything to stop it, which is kind of counterintuitive, but I think we've had a discussion about this before. Why doesn't the EU want gas? Because it's one of those cutting nose off to spite face issues. In any case, the moment the pipeline negotiations started sort of operationalizing things and saying, okay, well, we're going to run pipes through Macedonia, bam, you have a revolt in Macedonia and you have armed terrorists, you know, attacking police and neighboring, you know, border villages and all that. And,
right.
And I mean, it's so obvious.
Well,
but
now
he's talking about it.
Let me stop you here for a second, because if I know Macedonia, and I don't know anything about Macedonia, but if I know Macedonia, the place is run by politicians, which means that the people probably hate their guts and want to overthrow them, so maybe it's just a coincidence.
It would be, except that there's way too many things happening at once. And you'll notice that every time there's an AstroTurf revolution, people start marching against corruption and, you know, well, politicians are corrupt. Well, yes, but your choice is currently between corrupt politician A and corrupt politician B. And you're telling me that all of a sudden corruption is your issue, but you're happy to vote for corrupt politician B? I mean, think of Ukraine. They were demonstrating against corruption there. And who do they elect first chance they get? A U.S. approved oligarch. So it's not that oligarchs per se are the problem. It's that the oligarchs not loyal to a certain foreign power are the problem. And so here, you know, here we have the situation again. The current president was actually put into place with U.S. support. He was a loyal U.S. client for the longest time. But when he realized that he's not getting any money out of the U.S. and that, you know, the West can't bail him out and he needs bailing out because they still have all sorts of problems with their name, with their recognition, you know, with the Bulgarians, with the Albanians. And in the grand scheme of things, the way Washington's strategy in the region has been organized, the Bulgarians and the Albanians will always have precedence over Macedonian interests just because of geopolitics, nothing personal. Mm-hmm. And so this guy decided, well, maybe I should, you know, try to do something on my own. And, well, if there's one thing that U.S. clients are never forgiven, it's trying to strike out on their own. And so here comes the other guy who's, you know, from the Reformed Communist Party. And he says, oh, I'm a democratic liberal Democrat with, you know, democratic democracy, and I'm against corruption, except that he was run out of office because of corruption. You know, his party was run out of office because of corruption. So it's one of those, yeah, you know, I get it that people are sick of corruption, but when you get professional demonstrators being funded by these, you know, U.S.-based NGOs and suitcases of cash popping up, and That's corruption too.
Yeah. Which, by the way, is that a proven fact in this case, or it's just pretty damn obvious?
Well, I have to be absolutely fair, obviously, and say that there's been all sorts of allegations flying back and forth, and that some pretty reputable, well-informed sources have actually tracked down all these, U.S.-based NGOs. And in fact, one of my colleagues at RT actually had an interview with the director of one of these foundations in at the demonstration in Skopje. And he's like, yeah, we're supporting this 1,000%. But we're an independent human rights, open democracy, liberalism type organization, and we're demonstrating against the corrupt government. And she was asking, well, don't you see anything incongruous with the fact that you are an organization funded by George Soros, who is a known, we all know who Soros works with? And he's like, no, this is perfectly legitimate. So, they admit it, but they don't see a problem with this at all. It's perfectly fine if George Soros decides to overthrow a government on a Tuesday, because that's what he does.
Yeah. All right, now, so, okay, let's try to sum this thing up, because it's complicated and nobody even knows where the hell Macedonia is right now, or where it was. And I know there are two different countries fighting over the name and all kinds of crap. So, what you're telling me is the Russians had a plan for a pipeline to run through Ukraine. Now that the Americans have overthrown the government in Ukraine, they've decided they don't want to risk that anymore. So now they're going to, they've canceled that, and now they want to run this pipeline across the Black Sea and then through Bulgaria and Macedonia to get to Europe. Now,
that was the original plan. That was called the South Stream. And that was planned about 10 years ago when the first Ukrainian gas crisis started. This is before 2014 coup.
Oh, it's the Nord Stream that would have gone through Ukraine.
North Stream is going through Germany. The old Soviet era pipelines are going through Ukraine already. It's just that the Ukrainian government tends to shut them down when they can't pay their own gas bill.
I got
they
you.
Think they
I
should
see.
Be getting it for free, but that's a whole different.
So the question was the two different routes around Ukraine, regardless, neither was to go through Ukraine at this point. Okay.
Right.
So.
Right. And
the Turkish, the South Stream and the Turkish Stream. Is that right?
And the South Stream was shut down when McCain went to Bulgaria and told them, tell Russians you can't do it. Mm. And the Turkish Stream, the only way it can actually go anywhere is through Greece and then north through Macedonia and then north into Serbia and then north into Hungary. So right now, because the U.S. government doesn't want this Russian gas to go into Europe because that would encourage commerce between Europe and Russia. And, according to the current crop of politicians running State Department, we need to, put up an iron wall towards Russia and, essentially recreate Cold War. What they want to do is stop this. And the way to stop this is to step on their client in Macedonia. And they thought they could do this by, taking 20,000 people out into the streets and then having these Albanians from Kosovo, which has been established as a sort of a vassal NATO state, after they separated it violently from Serbia, have these Albanians cross into the border, occupy a village, and basically show the world that the government doesn't have control over anything, and that should have overthrown the government simply because it would lose support of the people. What happened was that the government actually sent special forces. They retook the village, killed a bunch of these terrorists, and then had like 100,000 people, or just about, march in support of the government, and like dwarfing the demonstrators completely. And so they basically turned the script upside down and said, we're not falling for this. We're going to stay in place. Am I going to defend these people as good, honest people? Hell no, they're politicians. They're corrupt by definition. But when you have the opposition politician essentially, replaying the script that we saw in Ukraine with the Maidan and with all these other color revolutions from Serbia onward that all resulted in not just a corrupt regime, but a corrupt client, like Quisling regime that serves not the voters or even the domestic special interests, which most governments do, but a foreign power.
You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. My interview of Nebojša Malić.
Place is, am I going to defend these people as you know, good, honest people? Hell no, they're politicians. They're corrupt by definition. But when you have the opposition politician essentially, you know, replaying the script that we saw in Ukraine with the Maidan and with all these other color revolutions from Serbia onward that all resulted in not just a corrupt regime, but a corrupt client, like Quisling regime that serves not the voters or even the domestic special interests, which most governments do, but a foreign power and directly takes order from the foreign power. Well, you know, if I have to choose between a thief and a Quisling, I would always pick a thief because at least he's my thief and I can, you know, eventually figure out a way to get rid of him myself. Now, of course, I'm not a Macedonian citizen and I don't live in Macedonia. I have some friends who do, and they're sort of divided on the issue because, you know, some of them are like, well, we need to get rid of corrupt politicians. And the others are like, well, yes, but we need to have our politicians, regardless of whether they're corrupt or not, as opposed to a Quisling. Mm-hmm. Well, look how well that's really out for Serbia, right?
That's a tough part about just being from a small country, is that there are major world empires in the world that have major interests. And so it's hard for you to take a stand on politics toward or against one group of people without – it's impossible to do so, really, without, in effect, siding with a foreign power. Same thing's going on in Syria right now. You're either a Russian sock puppet or an American one, an Israeli one or an Iranian one.
Yeah, pretty much. And then, I mean, with Syria, of course, that's a situation in which hundreds of thousands have actually gotten killed over the past 5 years, and it's a full-blown civil war that's – you know, more brutal and more disastrous than anything we've seen in the Balkans in the 90s. And we thought, you know, that was a big deal. It certainly was to us who lived there at the time, obviously. But, you know, I won't mince words. Syria is 10 times worse than anything that I've seen in Bosnia.
Yeah, no, it's an absolute catastrophe. There's no doubt about that. So, okay, now, but are they, so far they have not been able to overthrow this guy, but they're just trying. They've decided we're just going to go outside and stay there until they get rid of him one way or the other, just like Milosevic style kind of thing, huh?
Well, yes, so far they have been doing that. From what I can tell from the reports that I've been getting from the area, they haven't been really successful at that. It's one of those – the problem with these color revolution scripts is that it's pretty much only one script.
Yeah, they wore it out already. They've done this 10 times, man.
Yeah. And if you know how to counter it with counter rallies and you know, shows of force at the proper time, and you don't allow yourself to be suckered into the assigned role, which, you know, the script is that the government reacts a certain way. And if it doesn't react a certain way, then the script really doesn't adapt very well. And so this guy seemed to have bucked the script successfully, and now they're probably going to try to, you know, frame him for something else. You know, they'll find a sex scandal, or they'll accuse somebody else of corruption. They'll try to switch the narrative to something else, because this was supposed to be done in a week. You know, this color revolution script, again, once it goes off the rails, it doesn't really work very well. So the fact that they haven't been able to get this done in a week, the fact that these, you know, these Albanian militants who took this village and were supposed to stay in the village as a symbol of the government's ineptitude were roundly defeated. And I think 18 or 20 of them ended up getting killed. And the Albanians in Kosovo had this, you know, grand ceremony and gave them a hero's funeral, pretty much putting the rest of Macedonia on notice that, you know, yes, this was an external operation aimed at their government. Mm-hmm. And there's honestly, you know, there's nothing that solidifies people more in good old fashioned nationalism, whether we like it or not, than a manifest external threat.
Yeah.
And so they proved rather imprudently in the eyes of their employers that this was an external threat. Had they kept mum about it, maybe somebody could have tried spinning the whole, oh, these weren't really Albanians from Kosovo. These were local disenfranchised, you know, people who need more human rights or something, just like they did back in 2001. Mm-hmm. But no, they you know, weren't really subtle about this. And so at this point, it seems like the government has solidified. If you remember a few, maybe.
So the protesters have gone inside, or they're still out there, or what?
Some are still out there. The problem is that the summers in Macedonia get pretty darn hot, so it's not going to be very good protesting weather next couple of months. So it's going to be too hot to protest.
Saying they've really shot themselves in the foot here, pretty bad already at this point.
They've pretty much shot their entire clip, I think. But this is my personal opinion. I'm not talking as an RT journalist, or this is just my personal feeling based on having observed many of these color revolutions. My personal feeling is that they've pretty much, the script is off the rails. They've shot their entire clip that they had, and they're going to try to find something new to hang this on. And it's going to be really, really difficult to keep momentum now that they haven't managed to achieve any of their initial objectives. And the worst part is that there's plenty of objectively decent people in that crowd that were initially activated, and they believed that they were fighting for truth, justice, democracy. And when it became blindingly obvious that they were being astroturfed, a lot of them kind of went home and said, maybe this was not such a great idea.
Right, yeah, I mean, you got to figure that, like you said, a manifest external threat. Hey, we hate the current guy, but we're not teaming up with outside powers against
him. Absolutely.
That'll wait. I mean, yeah, people who hated George W. Bush, who still rallied around George W. Bush, they didn't stop hating him, but they still rallied around him after the attack because, hey, you can't attack us, and he's our alpha leader and all this kind of crap,
Well, can you imagine an anti-war demonstration with like the black flag of ISIS?
Right.
That would go off like a lead balloon, and the opposition leader has actually been photographed, waving the Albanian flag about, not just the flag of the local ethnic Albanian faction. No, the actual Albanian flag of Albania proper. And I mean, this is about as, that's not going to go over well.
Right. Not subtle at all. So, so that's interesting. A color-coded revolution that seems to be stalling. And then, so how big of a victory would that be for Putin then if this continues? They go ahead and build the pipeline and he gets what he wants.
Well, if the pipeline goes through, that achieves several things. The Washington definitely loses leverage over these small countries where the pipeline is going. For example, Macedonia, Serbia. Greece definitely gets a leg to stand on, because right now they have nothing regarding the European Union. The EU can pretty much say, pay up or else. And they can't even threaten the exit because that would collapse their government. Whereas if they had the pipeline, they could say, hey, about them gas pipes that were running. So that would be an issue. Macedonia would definitely have more leverage in terms of getting its name recognized and being recognized as independent of Bulgaria and Albania, which are two major U.S. clients in the region. I won't even call them allies, that can threaten it to dismember it at any point. The Serbian government, if it ever decided to rediscover its spine, would have something to stand on. Hungarian government, which has also survived an attempted color revolution, the Hungarians would also have something more to stand on than they already do. So, and you're looking at Europeans who would be getting gas at much cheaper prices than the U.S. liquid offer, if and when they ever build terminals to receive it, would be. I mean, there's this whole, the Europeans don't have to import gas from Russia. We'll just send them American, cheap American gas. It's not cheap. It's like 10 times more expensive. And its market valuation is just completely unviable. So that's definitely going to encourage commerce between Europe and Russia, which, again, is what the Russian government has been advocating for years. So that would be a major political I wouldn't call it so much as a victory for Putin, because he's not really looking for war. He's looking for commerce, whereas Washington is trying to build this wall in Eastern Europe, and that wall would not be able to exist if this pipeline goes through.
Mm. Well, and now, it seems like the Europeans are shooting themselves in the foot here, applying pressure, and I guess they already failed to apply enough pressure to stop the Macedonians from wanting to do this, right? That's why they've now had to go to the extent of trying to overthrow the government there, because, and why are they so willing to act contrary to their own interests just because America says so?
Well, the leadership of the EU is pretty much loyal to the Atlantic consensus. It's NATO that runs European foreign policy for all intents and purposes. And so you've got these individual countries that are looking out for themselves, but you know, you have this whole situation where the French had a multi-billion dollar deal to build some ships for the Russian Navy, and they're trying to Welsh on it now, and they're trying to cut their losses, and the Russians are saying, well, you know, if you break the contract, you're going to have to pay double what the contract was, and you can't afford it. So who's going to cover your losses? We're going to end up getting paid either way, ships or no ships, but who's going to cover your losses? The U.S.? Nobody's off. No, the U.S. is not offering to make up for it, so the French are in a bind now. You've got the Germans who are hurting economically because of this whole
trade. All right, well, Russia. There's still another couple of minutes left on this interview. You know how it goes. You'll be able to find the whole thing at scotthorton.org/interviews. Time warp. Right back with Will Grigg in a minute. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, all Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. And, you know, I'm sorry, of course, I never time these things well. There's plenty of me that could have been edited out of that interview, obviously. But you'll be able to find the whole thing of that interview in Neboj Samalich at scotthorton.org/interviews soon. You know, probably tonight or tomorrow morning or something. All right, on the line, I got our good friend, Will Grigg. And I've already convinced him to stay for the whole hour with us because we have so much different stuff to talk about. And he's such a great journalist, covers so many very important things. And I'm sorry because I meant to talk to you about this off the air real quick, but got a little sidetracked there. Will, I was hoping first of all, we could talk about the story of Kenneth Trenadue and Jesse Trenadue. And where they are now in the court process in Utah. This is such an important story, and I think it's just as interesting to the audience as it is to me. So, could you give us the rundown? I know you can.
Kenneth Trenadue was murdered by the FBI. There's no other suitable way of describing it. He had served time in prison as a bank robber, and he was on parole when the Oklahoma City bombing took place in April of 1995. He was visiting his wife's family in northern Mexico, and he came across a border crossing just a week or two after the bombing. And he had been red flagged by our overseers, and he was arrested and taken into custody for a supposed parole violation, which he hadn't committed, and then flown to a facility fairly near Ground Zero, the site of the former Murrah Building in Oklahoma City, where he was interrogated by the FBI and a group of other people. And by interrogated, I mean he was beaten to death systematically. There was evidence that he had been garroted, among other things. He had sold himself dear. Now, the reason why he was taken into custody is because he bore an uncanny resemblance, both in terms of physiognomy and criminal career, to a man by the name of Richard Lee Guthrie, who was part of a Midwestern bank robbery gang, an Aryan Nations offshoot that had been sponsored and infiltrated by elements of the federal government, including the FBI. And so he was a loose thread that needed to be knitted up after what was probably a bad sting operation gone awry in Oklahoma City that led to the death of 169 people. He was not Mr. Guthrie. Mr. Guthrie was elsewhere within the bowels of the American gulag. He was already in custody, but one appendage of the Hydra didn't know what the other was doing. And because he bore resemblance to Mr. Guthrie and because he had been a bank robber, He was mistaken for Mr. Guthrie and then taken and killed. And within about a year, Mr. Guthrie likewise died in his cell under circumstances that were highly suspicious. He supposedly hanged himself in spite of the fact that he had promised that he would disclose what he had known about the federal government's dealings with the people out of whom the Oklahoma City bombing plot coalesced. But within a day, less than a day of the death of Kenny Trenadue, his mother was contacted by the warden and told that he had committed suicide in his cell, and he wanted permission to cremate the body, which of course would have destroyed the evidence. Kenny's brother, Jesse, is an attorney, and Jesse filed the right paperwork and issued the proper notices and made the proper ritual invocations in order to prevent the destruction of his brother's body. They obtained custody of his body, and it was so thoroughly traumatized that it would have required the services of Cleopatra's embalmers in order to make it look suitable and presentable for an open casket funeral. But Jesse demanded that there be an open casket funeral because he wanted people to see the handiwork of the federal government. They had gone through and sanitized the cell. They had tried to maintain the pretense that he had killed himself when it was clear, as the coroner pointed out in his report, that this was the result of homicide, not suicide. And both Jesse and the coroner received very stern warnings, not particularly subtle ones as well, that they were making enemies within the Bureau of Prisons and that it was just one federal government. If you were not going along with the program, if you were not embracing the official cover story in a way that discomfited the ambitions of the people running the federal government, in any particular, you were making enemies out of everybody. So since that time, this would have been 1995, 20 years, Jesse Trenadue has been doing what he can in order to find out how it was that his brother ended up where he was, dying the way he did. And in doing so, he has managed through a barrage of Freedom of Information requests and through civil action, he's pried loose a great deal of material about this so-called sting operation that was run through an off-the-shelf FBI long-term initiative called PATCON, or Patriot Conspiracy. And it didn't limit itself to what was going on in Oklahoma City. There were appendages and tendrils of PATCON that were woven into many, many projects and many domestic terrorism initiatives. And one of the things that I wrote about recently, by way of bringing this back to the surface, was the fact that just within the last couple of years, John Matthews, who was the chief asset, a Vietnam veteran suffering from apparently fatal Agent Orange effects, he was the person being used by the FBI as a cat's paw to infiltrate not merely the so-called radical right groups, but people who were to the right, marginally to the right of what's considered the acceptable political spectrum. But John Matthews, in talking with his handler within the FBI, a man by the name of Don Jarrett, brought up the fact that they had been in the FBI in the mid-1990s making overtures to outlaw motorcycle gangs in the southwestern United States, Arizona primarily, but of course there's a geographic range that would include Texas and New Mexico and some other states, where the FBI was providing them with illegally converted, fully automatic machine guns, and doing so at the same time that groups associated with, I'm guessing from what I read, Chinese triad criminal societies were smuggling heroin to the United States. This is something being done with the knowledge of the FBI and the active participation of the FBI. And when I got a hold of the material from Mr. Trenadue, along with a number of other journalists, been involved in a long-term relationship where he's been sharing material with me, and relatively few of us have been interested in it, which I find just utterly implausible. But he provided me with some of the email correspondence in question where he had mentioned these transactions, and Mr. Jarrett, his former FBI handler, confirmed the details of it. So I sent a message to the office of the Inspector General at the Justice Department saying, in effect, do you want to do anything about this? Because here we have on the record a man who is an FBI asset talking with his FBI handler about the fact that the 1990s you had something very nearly akin to the Fast and Furious gunwalking scandal that the ATF was involved in just a few years ago, but it involved outlaw motorcycle gangs, outlaw motorcycle clubs, I should say, OMCs. Is this something that you might want to look into? And I got back a very perfunctory message a few days later saying, well, we've examined the allegations. They don't strike us as being worthy of a formal investigation. And I brought this up more recently in a posting I made at the LouRockwell.com blog site, mm-hmm. talking about what happened in Waco and the fact that you had outlaw motorcycle gangs supposedly involved in a shootout. Turns out there's not a whole lot of evidence that they were the ones who were shooting. But I said in the larger context here, you've got to understand that the federal government, through PADCON, has, among other very nasty initiatives, been arming and working with those elements within the OMC community, if you want to style it as such, who have been involved in narcotic smuggling and other criminal activity. And this is the sort of thing that we find so frequently, as you well know, Scott, whenever there's any kind of large-scale criminal undertaking in this country, the chances are pretty good that it has been not only surveilled but infiltrated by the federal government and co-opted toward their political ends, which don't involve protecting persons and property, but do involve underscoring the supposed indispensability of these various agencies.
Right.
So that at budget time they can go before the Congress and demand a greater outpouring of plundered revenue in order to fund the people who are employed by that agency. And the other thing that I find interesting that I brought up in the context of what happened in Waco recently is the fact that in the late years of the last decade, 2006 through about 2009, there was a so-called outlaw motorcycle club called the Pagans that had been infiltrated and kept under surveillance by the Justice Department. And they were talking about this group as if it were a large-scale criminal syndicate. They retained the FBI, retained the services as sergeant of arms of a convicted murderer in that group. And eventually the only thing they got by way of criminal activity was evidence that they had been running a raffle, which doesn't strike me really as a badass biker type of thing to do.
All right. Well, there's so much to follow up on, but we're going to have to wait till after this break. Hold tight, everybody. It's Will Grigg from Pro Libertate, freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. You know, I didn't even give Will a proper introduction at all. Will Grigg. Isn't he great? Well, listen to the things he says, man. It's awesome. All right, he's also a brilliant writer, and you can find him at Freedom in Our Time, he insists, really. freedominourtime.blogspot.com. And the blog is Pro Libertate. He's also the author of the book Liberty in Eclipse and does the Freedom Zealot podcast. And so we're talking about PatCon and Oklahoma City and Jesse and Kenneth Trenadue, and now even the local massacre in Waco has come up in terms of the precedent in the PatCon operation, the FBI's PatCon operation to infiltrate the radical right in the 90s and their arming of motorcycle gangs. And now but I wanted to rewind to what you said here at Lou Rockwell's blog, and also just now you kind of made reference to it. You seem to think, and I wonder why, that the people killed there, the bikers killed there, were all or mostly all shot by the cops rather than each other.
So far, we don't have any identified shooters within the 170 people who are rounded up on organized crime charges that are tainted with the prospect of being held in some way criminally liable for 9 counts of criminal homicide. And the nature of the shooting, in terms of what I've been able to find out, the wounds that were inflicted, the fatal wounds inflicted on the victims, are not what you would see if you had a melee erupting in a parking lot and people firing wildly while trying to find cover, which is the sort of thing that you'd have if you're dealing with people who are not particularly well-trained and not all that well-prepared for a gunfight spontaneously to erupt. There were people who fled back into the restaurant after the shooting began. Some of them were arrested in the restaurant. And we do know that there were people with the police who are snipers and who had the high ground, and it seems to me very plausible at this point, given what little we know, that the 9 people were all killed by the police, or perhaps most of the 9 people were killed by the police, after perhaps a random act of gunfire or the eruption of the fight. And concerns over gunfire, emerging as the fight escalated. But right now, we just don't have any evidence to connect any of the people who have been arrested with any specific shooting.
I presume them all innocent.
Well, of course we should, and it's constitutionally mandated and morally appropriate to presume them all innocent. I do find it interesting that you had this Officer Brelo case in Cleveland where you had, what, 149 shots fired at a stationary car and the officer himself climbing on top of the hood and reloading at least once and firing into the windshield to kill these two people who were unarmed and at this point cut off and helpless. You had, I don't know how many law enforcement officers involved in this, what we would have to call homicide, who refused to cooperate with the prosecution or to file statements. The reason why the judge, and this is a bench trial, of course, they weren't going to put this before a jury, the reason why the judge decided that Officer Brelo could not be held guilty for criminal homicide is because he could not specifically connect any of his gunshots to the fatal wounds that were inflicted on that couple. And yet we have 170 people in the state of Texas right now, almost none of whom had anything to do with the fight, and to this day so far, none of whom has been connected to any of the gunshots that were fired. But they're all being held right now and facing the prospect of some element of criminal liability for the killing of nine people who are probably killed by the police, which makes perfect sense if you understand how what we're told to call the law operates in America right now as opposed to the way it's supposed to function.
Right. In other words, they're looking for when they can shoot, and then they do at the minimum. That's it.
Yes. And they, of course, knew that this meeting was going to take place. This meeting was not some kind of a gang summit, because you're not dealing with gangs. You're dealing with motorcycle clubs that at the edges are somewhat tainted by criminal conduct on behalf of discrete individual members of these motorcycle clubs. This is something that had been long planned and that had, to the extent that we've been given in public information what was going on, that had nothing to do with plotting or carrying out criminal activity. It's been characterized by some people as simply a way of clearing the air involving territorial disputes among these private organizations that, to some extent, flatter themselves that they're kingdoms or principalities of some sort. This wasn't the sort of thing, in other words, that would have made really good copy or made really good drama for Sons of Anarchy, which is the lens through which most of the public now is perceiving what happened there in Waco. And as a point of personal privilege here, in my former career as a musician, I spent a lot of time in, if you will, the biker milieu, playing in biker bars and dealing with bikers, and I have never had a problem with any of them. When I was living in Rexburg, Idaho as a teenager, Rexburg, Idaho being a stop on the way to Yellowstone, every July or August, the Hell's Angels would materialize literally across the street from my house on the corner, because there was only one bar in this Mormon town. It was called Poor Old Don's Place, and their parking lot would be filled with the motorcycles of the Hell's Angels as they would go there and refuel on the way to West Yellowstone. Now, the cops would hover at the periphery, and we didn't have any problems at all. So I'm not particularly put off by outlaw motorcycle clubs. I've often told my children, if you find yourself in a strange city and you're in trouble, try to find a biker. A biker will help. A police officer may or may not. And so I'm not particularly put off by any of this. I am, however, put off by the fact that there is this assumption that a group of bikers assembling at a, forgive me for using the expression, titty bar, are going to be troublesome to the people who live in that community. What I think here is that you have overcompensation on the part of law enforcement coupled with a certain opportunistic spin that's being put on this incident after the fact. And I would be willing to bet that as the facts come out, assuming that we're going to be given the facts, we'll find out that some bad things took place, that there were pushing and shoving incidents, and there were other unpleasantries that ensued, but that this was the product of overreaction by the police, and after the fact they're trying to put some kind of a cosmetic enhancement on it to make it look as if they had aborted a horrible potential threat to the community here when the threat was entirely of their own contrivance. I suspect that's what we're going to learn.
Yeah. All right, now, so let's get back to the PatCon operation in the 90s here and the story of this guy, John Matthews, who was the undercover informant or asset or whatever of the FBI during that time. There's a lot going on here, and Jesse Trenadu had sent me this a link to Sipsey Street Irregulars, blogspot.com. And what they have there is what they say is the full version, the uncensored version of a Newsweek article by R.M. Schneiderman, who did a serious piece of journalism about this PacCon informant and his story. And apparently huge pieces of it were cut out, at least according to this blog. Well, so I called Jesse Trenadue, and he never had a copy of the article, but they read him the whole thing on the phone, and he said, yeah, this is the censored part, all right. It's, you know, trust me, it's legit. And that the Newsweek people had talked to him, and that they had done a serious piece of journalism here. Only all the best parts had been cut to the editing room floor before it got publication. And so this all has to go has to do with, of course, Jesse's case as it moves forward, and in fact, the current state of the court at trial right now. And the judge's orders to the FBI and all that. So that's where we'll pick up on the other side of this break that we're already at again. Sorry. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. Hey, I'm Scott. It's my show. Scott Horton Show. I got Will Grigg on the line from freedominourtime.blogspot.com. And we're talking about the FBI's PacCon operation back in the 1990s, infiltrating the populist right from harmless to Nazi, and making more and worse of them all the time, and in fact, including the Oklahoma City bombing in some ways. And now part of the reason that we know that, and we already knew that, but part of the reason we know that is because of this guy, John Matthews. And if I have this right, Will, Jesse Trenadue, who you previously described his role in all of this, suing in the courts in Utah there, I guess the federal courts in Utah, he's got an actual FOIA trial going on to get the videotapes, all the surveillance tapes that he knows exist and can prove exist, of the Oklahoma City bombing that, of course, would show McVeigh's accomplice with him rather than him being alone like in the mythology there. And so, but now he wanted to bring John Matthews to explain to the judge why this is a thing and you ought to let Jesse win this side of the thing. And yet John Matthews, the former FBI informant, now turned, plaintiff's informant, is nowhere to be found. What gives?
What gives is that the FBI is strongly invested in preventing Mr. Matthews from testifying. He's living outside of the jurisdiction of a civil subpoena in this case out of Salt Lake City. And during a conversation that he had almost a year ago, July 9th of 2014, with then FBI Special Agent Adam Quirk in Salt Lake City, Mr. Matthews said that he was not going to obey a subpoena, or if he was forced to testify, if somehow he'd end up within the radius of jurisdiction here and he was compelled to attend the trial in Salt Lake City, he'd perjure himself. He said this in a phone conversation with Adam Quirk, who was an officer of the FBI and an attorney and an officer of the court, somebody who had sworn perjuriously in oath of the Constitution and who is morally, legally, and constitutionally required to tell this man that he has a duty to testify, tell the truth, may the heavens fall. But that's not what Quirk said. What Matthew said in that phone conversation is, I ain't going and I ain't saying nothing unless somebody issues me a subpoena. He said, if they haul my ass to Salt Lake City, I'm going to sit there on the stand and say that I don't recall anything. And Quirk replied, that's fine. And then on the following day, they had a subsequent conversation. And Quirk said, worst case scenario, even if you testified, you can just say that you have nothing to say. And Matthews was eager to please Quirk because of fear of retribution against his family. That's an important element in some of the legal filings that Mr. Trenadue has made here. He was concerned about the potential of retaliation against himself and against his family, cutting off the payments upon which he depends for his treatment for Agent Orange effects. But Matthew was obviously motivated to please Quirk. He suggested that he might take a trip and thereby make himself unavailable in the event that a subpoena was issued. And Quirk replied, "That's fine," and then using the familiar Anglo-Saxon vulgarism, blank them, right? In other words, you know, blank the court, blank the judge, perform a similar action upon the interests of Mr. Trenadue and Mr. Trenadue's family. And, of course, their only interest now, as you pointed out, Scott, is to try to pry loose from whatever place it's concealed the videotapes that show Mr. McVeigh in the company of the others unknown listed in the original indictment back in 1995. Very few people remember, because very few people remember anything about the case, apart from the fact that Mr. McVeigh was convicted and executed for the crime. Very few people remember that the indictment listed Timothy McVeigh and others unknown. And the others unknown have remained unknown. And this John Doe 2, or John Doe's, but let's personify this as one individual for the purposes of this discussion. This John Doe 2 remains at large, an accomplice in what had been the largest act of terrorism on American soil to be committed to that point, and what remains to this day the largest act of domestic terrorism, in which 169 people, including 17 small children, were murdered. And the FBI obviously is not doing what it can, contrary to its oft-repeated intentions of overturning every stone and beating every brush and doing whatever it can to extract and make public all the evidence having to do with this crime. And it's only, and I use the term only, I guess, in shock quotes, it's only 20 years ago that this happened. We're not talking about the JFK assassination or the Martin Luther King assassination. Yeah. We're not rummaging around in...
As long as we're talking shelf life, right? Like yeah. Bill Hicks said.
Yeah, it's still within, I would think, the routine and expected and predictable half-life of public attention for yeah. those who are adults. I mean, this is something that had a tremendous impact on the public mind. There were legislative initiatives that happened in the wake of that atrocity. Much of what we're putting up with now in terms of the suffocating enhancements of security at airports actually began after Oklahoma City, not after 9/11. And every episode of that sort where you've got, in this case, clear pre-knowledge on the part of the FBI, if not active involvement of people controlled by the FBI in that crime. Mm-hmm. And in the case of 9/11, you have many FBI agents with whom I spoke 15 years ago, almost, telling me that people had anticipated that attack in lower Manhattan on or about that day, and they had been prevented from doing their jobs. You and I have talked with people who have been involved in the Bureau trying to prevent that attack. But every time the government fails in this fashion, it actually succeeds spectacularly, because government is the only human enterprise that actually profits through its failure, because it acquires more power and more resources and less accountability.
And the highest level officials on this case have admitted it on the record, too.
Yes.
I forgot which Danny, Coulson or Deffenbaugh or both, or what, both of those guys, FBI agents, are on the record saying, yeah, we think the neo-Nazis did it. And, of course, they're referring to guys who were, you know, at least halfway state's witnesses and federal agents, you know, down to the last man. And then even in the new book, Oklahoma, relatively new book, a couple years old, by Gumbel and Charles, Oklahoma City, in there they have the prosecutor on the case, on the federal case, saying that if you had our entire team together, we would all agree that, yeah, we let guilty go free. Yeah. Their excuse is because they wanted to make sure that McVeigh got the death penalty. And if they admitted that any more people were in on it than that, then he might get less than the death penalty, and that was not kosher whatsoever. So in order to make sure that he got killed, they had to let the rest go free. That was their rationalization anyway. Although, of course, we know the real story is because they were up to their eyeballs in it, and as you just said, had all the prior knowledge in the world that they needed, that they could have stopped the attack with.
They could have interdicted it very easily. And you're talking, for the most part, about the denizens of Elohim City, which was this neo-Nazi enclave that was overrun with people who were connected to at least one, and in many instances, more than one federal agency. Or in the case of Andras Strassmeyer, somebody who was involved with not only the U.S. FBI and probably the ATF and most likely the CIA, but also probably German intelligence. It reminds me of, quite frankly, some of the episodes of Get Smart, which, as is the case with most parodies, tells more truth than straight entertainment or even straight history. There were many episodes of Get Smart where Maxwell Smart and his control agents would go in and bust a cabal of chaos agents and find out that all the chaos agents were double agents working either for control of the CIA or British intelligence. And this is the sort of thing, of course, that can extract sort of a wry chuckle if it's portrayed in a sitcom. But this is an instance where you had pretty much the same thing happening, in which almost 170 Americans died. And the one person who's been trying to find out some substantial element of the truth here is the brother of a man who was murdered by the FBI in a case of mistaken identity because they believed that he was one of the assets that had been let free, that he was one of the John Does, one of the multiple right. John Does involved in either a feeder to the plot to bomb the Murrah building or involved on the scene. And the FBI, of course, has institutional reasons not to be fully candid about what's going on. And keeping these videotapes hidden away with the Ark of the Covenant, that vast warehouse that we saw at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark. But what Trudeau has been doing, and he's been winning in court, he's been winning repeated motions, is to get the FBI on the record and force them on pain of contempt of court to comply with their obligations under the Freedom of Information Act. And yet a year ago, they intimidated the key witness so that he couldn't testify. And as you say, that court case is still ongoing.
All right, hold it right there. We'll be right back. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here, and I'm so excited about Commodity Discs from CommodityDiscs.com. They're one-ounce silver pieces with a QR code engraved on the backside. Scan the code with your phone and get the instant spot price. Commodity Discs are paving the way forward for the alternative currency community in America and around the world. The QR code Commodity Disc. Technology has now finally made a real free market silver currency viable. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at ScottHorton.org/donate gets one free. That's CommodityDiscs.com. All right, guys, welcome back. On the phone with Will Grigg from Pro Libertate. That's his great blog. It's a collection of articles more than a blog, really. It's not really a blog. These aren't blog entries. This is journalism. Freedominourtime.blogspot.com for Pro Libertate. And check out his podcast, The Freedom Zealot, and check out his book, Liberty in Eclipse, as well. All right, so, so much to talk about here. To sum up, only one more segment left. But I want to mention again this thing at SIPSEY, which is SIPSEY, SIPSEY Street Irregulars.blogspot.com. And Jesse Trenadue himself sent me these links, and it's to the censored version of the Newsweek story, the whole thing. And here's this guy, John Matthews, the witness, tell the whole thing to a reporter from Newsweek. And it got censored. But not only did Jesse Trenadue tell me that they had read him, the reporter read him the whole article over the phone. And so he can verify that, yeah, this is all what was in there. This is legit stuff here. And you can tell that it is. This is clearly the same article as the rest of the article. Just the redacted portions. Brought back to life here. But he said that, in fact, Newsweek, the reporter and Newsweek called him and said, hey, did you leak this? And he said, no, guys, I didn't have it. You only read it to me over the phone. But so that's, you know, definitely the verification that this is legitimately the excised portions of this article. And it wasn't the reporter who leaked it. It was somebody else because the reporter called Jesse saying, hey, did you give out this article? So, very important stuff here. And here he is, this guy Matthews, saying, yep, I saw Strassmeyer and McVeigh together in San Saba, Texas, training. And there were other FBI informants there, too, and on. A very well-reported story here, Will. And now this is the guy that is on the lam because the FBI is obstructing justice and told him to not go to court when he'd been subpoenaed in a civil case, but still to show up in court and testify what he already spilled his entire guts to Jesse Trenadue in depositions. I believe, I everything he had to say, or pretty much, and then also to Newsweek here.
What I also find interesting is that Don Jarrett, this fellow who was his FBI handler in this PATCON operation, wound up in Afghanistan a couple of years ago doing what? I don't know. But he's somebody who still is involved in some covert way with military intelligence or domestic law enforcement, or do I repeat myself twice? So this individual, Don Jarrett, is still part of whatever supporting mechanism gave rise to PatCon. And I think it's a pretty good way to look at this if you assume that PatCon is in some sense either the sibling or the offspring of COINTELPRO. COINTELPRO began in the 1950s under Hoover, and it was an operation intended to infiltrate and manipulate the radical right and the radical left. So you had groups such as the American Indian Movement and various of the movements associated with civil rights, people who were close to Martin Luther King, people who were involved in the Black Panthers. The Black Panthers was a high-priority target for COINTELPRO. AIM, the American Indian Movement I mentioned before, was likewise a fairly high-priority target. In both the case of AIM and in the case of the Black Panthers, you had murders that were brought about through instigation and through provocation and then covered up in large measure through the justice system as an outgrowth of COINTELPRO. And at the same time, you had Klan organizations and neo-Nazi groups that were likewise being infiltrated and manipulated by the FBI through COINTELPRO. So when PatCon came online, most likely in the late 1980s or early 1990s, it was something that was an off-the-shelf operation using standard-issue parts that the FBI had assembled for use during the 1960s and 1950s. And once again, Don Jarrett, this fellow who is running John Matthews, his control within PatCon, is still very much active in whatever it is the regime is doing both overseas and most likely here at home. When I published this piece a year ago, the last line of my article was something to the effect of, we'll hear from them again. We can assume as much because they're investing this much time and effort and energy in preventing full disclosure over something that happened 20 years ago in Oklahoma City, admittedly a very consequential thing that happened 20 years ago in Oklahoma City. Mm-hmm. But in spite of the fact that the case supposedly is still open, they're not pursuing these leads that are being turned up by Jesse Trenadu and that are ending up in print in supposedly reputable publications like Newsweek and in other venues such as SSI, the Cipsey Street Irregulars, who do tremendous work. Roger Charles, who used to be with ABC News, a retired Marine officer, mm-hmm. is likewise still doing spade work to uncover what's going on. And he provided to Trenadu a number of very key documents dealing with the extent to which the FBI has agents of influence in place at ABC News and in other major journalistic outlets, such as Newsweek, one would assume. It reminds me, Scott, of nothing so much as the KGB's practice of having what they call the Zampolit, a political officer who'd be installed in all of these institutions of consequence in Soviet Russia, including, of course, Pravda and TASS and some of the other media affiliates of that regime. You have the FBI doing precisely the same thing for exactly the same reason. I contend that's why you ended up with this emasculated version of the PatCon story being run by Newsweek. The Zampolit got to them and yeah. made sure that he excised or she excised whatever would be compromising to the interests of the FBI.
Well, and there's important lessons here about government work overall here, I think, because, you know, the average person would think, well, I hope the FBI is keeping a close watch on a bunch of crazy neo-Nazis, bank robbers and Klansmen, and you know, if they're really that far to the white supremacist right that they're going to commit acts of terrorism against civilians, then by golly, the FBI better be keeping a close watch. And yet what we have here is the FBI creating a radical right where there wasn't one, creating bank robbery rings where there weren't one, creating terrorist bombings where they did not exist before, and that kind of thing. And so, but of course, what are they going to do? Have a tiny little PatCon operation? No. Once you have a PatCon operation, you got a bunch of people whose job it is to come up with more work to do. And so it just grows and grows and grows until a whole lot of people get killed. And, I mean, what else would you expect? I hate to sound all grizzled and old and wise, but this is how it works, you know?
Over the last decade, of course, we've seen the same playbook being used now for Homeland Security theater operations involving Muslims, where you have people who have been referred to in federal criminal trials as terrorism facilitators. Now, wrap your mind around that expression, terrorism facilitators. In other words, confidential informants, many of whom are petty criminals. In some instances, you're dealing with some really nasty guys who are used to attract the attention of socially marginal and often not particularly bright young Muslim men and get them riled up over the things that the government is doing overseas to Muslims. That's one of the interesting aspects of that branch of what the regime is doing. Mm-hmm. rather than talking about the impudence of infidels who refuse to grow beards or women who show their ankles or so forth, the grievances that are used to militarize and radicalize young Muslim men in these Homeland Security theater operations have to do with the conduct of the regime overseas when they're killing women and children. And then they're told that by way of some kind of asymmetrical warfare to retaliate against the government doing these things, they should blow up a Christmas tree in Portland, or they should set off a satchel bomb in Chicago, or some such nonsense of this kind. It's all being carried out through the ministrations of the Homeland Security Theater Troop and these so-called terrorism facilitators. There's a lawsuit underway right now involving a fellow named Craig Montiel, who was a terrorism facilitator in Orange County, California, as part of an FBI initiative called Operation Flex. And he infiltrated a mosque and was trying to get people to go along with whatever plan the FBI was feeding to him. And so the people at the mosque contacted the FBI to complain about what was happening. And one of them ends up being threatened with deportation for outing their confidential informant. That's the sort of thing you're describing here.
And they got off lucky. Yeah, exactly.
I know.
All right, now I'm sorry because we're so short on time. I don't have time for both of these things. I'm going to interview you again soon about this. I hope you're going to write about it. This U.S. Supreme Court decision upholding the doctrine of qualified immunity that's never been created by any legislature in this land, I don't believe, which is so important in the case of these cops who kicked in this crazy lady's door and killed her. But we don't have time for that because at the end, I got to talk about what we are going to have is a fun drive for Will. It's only in idea form now. But you, dear listeners, especially those listening live right now, you can get a head start on the new fundraising drive that we've got for Will Grigg and his great journalism at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. And all you got to do is just go to any page at Pro Libertate there, freedominourtime.blogspot.com, and you can find a donate by PayPal link right there in the right-hand margin. And usually at the end of each great article, too, which you'll want to read all of them to the end. So conveniently, there's another button right down there at the end of each article. And I will insist that you go and read Will Grigg, and I will ask you to kindly donate and help get this fun drive kicked off right. Thank you so much for your time on the show. It's so great to talk to you again, Will.
God, that means a lot to me. Thank you.
Appreciate it. That's freedominourtime.blogspot.com. See you tomorrow. Thanks.